I think we're going to just jump right in and introduce our lovely panelists. And so let's just, in 1 minute, talk a little bit about yourselves.
Well, I have a 15-minute PowerPoint presentation that I'd like to make just to talk about me. Oh, you don't want me to talk all that much about that. Okay, I'll go really fast. My name is Beth Reeves. I'm head of human resources for AmeriHealth Caritas, which is a healthcare company that serves the poor, founded originally by the Sisters of Mercy. And we provide Medicaid and Medicare for our members, and we are growing like crazy. We have we will potentially double our size by 2016. We have about 3,800 employees currently, and I think we will have about 6,000 by the time we finish our growth spurt. So our mission is that we help people get care, stay well, build healthy communities. We have a special concern for the poor. My early career was with GE and GE Capital. I was on the Corporate Human Resources Management Program with GE, and my specialty was international HR work. I was there for over 18 years, so it's where I grew up and cut my teeth. My HR roles have varied by industry. I've been the chief HR officer for four publicly traded companies, Lincoln Financial Group, which I see some of my Lincoln colleagues, former Lincoln colleagues here, Liz Claiborne, which is a fashion company in New York City, and XL Group, which was domiciled in Dublin, Ireland. I've been married to the same man for over 30 years. I have two wonderful daughters who are Gen Y, and, you know, I have to really help them because they need me. They need me to help them. I have four Labradors and one cat who thinks he's a dog, and I've lived in Philadelphia for 8 years. I'm on the board of the Ronald McDonald House and the Support Center for the Child Advocates. But maybe the real reason I'm here is because I'm the old gal. I'm the baby boomer representative on the panel, or as my husband would say, the hot flash generation. We are highly motivated, hardworking, and we believe in the career ladder, the fundamental Puritan ethic, damn it. We work hard and you will be rewarded, but you must pay your dues. So we are more interested in how hard you work and the results that you get. As we age, we've gotten a wee bit more flexible, and we are seeking our own version of work-life integration much more than we did in our earlier careers. So I'm very excited to be here today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sorry to see you.
Hi, I'm Jill Ross. I'm market director for Beneficial Bank. Beneficial Bank has a wonderful booth out there, but we found it in Philadelphia 160 years ago. We were founded for the immigrants of Philadelphia because there wasn't a place for them to bank. Our mission has always been to do what's right, and we continue that mission. It's really about educating people to do the right thing financially. I've worked for a lot of financial institutions and feel really passionate about the work we do at Beneficial is to help people do what's right. I've been in financial services for 18 years. I started my career at Commerce Bank. I was there for 10 years in different roles. I started my management career about 16 years ago, managing people from age 16 to 80. I then went into wealth and finance with Smith Barney and Wachovia Wealth Management, and then came to Beneficial about 5 years ago. So I am the sandwich generation, which is Gen X, and I have two Gen Y sisters, but I manage a variety of different women and men, obviously, all with different perspectives, all with creativity, and to look at the stereotypical of the generations is something really interesting to look at, and it is like a bell curve, so we'll kind of talk about that today. A little bit about me. I grew up in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. I married my high school sweetheart. We're still married. I have a 20-month-year-old son and two rat terriers. They all sleep in the same bed with me, and I'm very excited to be here on the panel. Turn it on to you.
Wow, what an awesome group of women, and what a great group of women to be here with. My name is Renata Black. I'm the founder of the 7 Bar Foundation. It's a foundation for the empowerment of women through microfinance. And for those of you who might not know what microfinance is, it's small loans to help women start their own businesses out of poverty. And I've been in microfinance since 2005, ever since I graduated from University of North Carolina, where obviously you're from. I took a trip around the world for a year after I graduated from college, and I was volunteering in India, and a woman, as I was cleaning the villages, I was wearing a tank top, you're not supposed to show your shoulders, and I hadn't washed my clothes in the river that day, and this woman came up to me, and I thought she was saying something about my shoulders, and I felt so bad, I was kind of embarrassed, and the translator came up to me, and she said, She's not saying anything about your shoulders. What she's saying is that she knows that you're American, and she knows that you know how to make money, and can you teach her how to make it? And I was 25 at that point. I'm 34 now. And ever since then, I have only done microfinance. I studied under Muhammad Yunus before he won the Nobel Peace Prize. I then went back to India, and I did microfinance with 800 women for 2 years. Doing this, I was able to see how microfinance empowered women and how teaching women to become self-sufficient was the most effective way to alleviate poverty, because then I would see their girls go to school, which is the best part. When I came back from that trip, I was watching the Victoria's Secret show, and I was like really befuddled after living in India and being so covered all the time on how women's sensuality was really used to objectify women. And I felt, what a shame to miss this energy and not use this beautiful energy of sensuality to empower women. Ever since then, since I came back from India, my foundation has been redirecting the power of lingerie to the empowerment of women, very much what you do as well. And since 2009, we've hosted top luxury lingerie shows with the top designers, Agent Provocateur, Karen Gilson, Fifi Shishnio, Atsuko Kudo, hosted shows in Miami, London, Lingerie Miami, Lingerie New York, and Lingerie London, and today have over 3.8 billion media impressions all about the empowerment of women. So my foundation, we don't raise funds through donations. Everything is business-based, because we tell women to fuel their businesses consistently through business. And so we fuel the foundation through cause marketing campaigns, through communication platforms, and all through products. We have a cause marketing campaign with top Fortune 500 companies, and also we have a product that's called Empowered by You. And it's a perfect everyday panty, and the title is Whatever Empowers You, Empowers Women Everywhere. So again, you know, I'm just a serial entrepreneur myself, and just finding innovative ways to fuel the empowerment of women consistently. So that's me and my story.
Welcome. Thank you. So that's the classic example of social entrepreneurship, the idea that you can do good business and actually do well. Do good for the world and do well for business. The concept of doing good and doing well, the classic example of social entrepreneurship. Just to give you a quick background of sort of my latest project, it's called Thinks, and Renata and I have a lot to talk about afterwards. But the idea is that, just a quick show of hands, how many girls here, this is separate of that conversation, but how many girls here have had an embarrassing moment during that time of the month at some point in their lives? All women should raise their hands at this point. Or have had, you know, when you sneeze, you have a little accident. There's 1 in 3 women have lead incontinence. Yeah, everyone. Yeah. So the question was, you know, in this day and age, when there's every technology and every technological solution and every app on planet Earth, including the worst game on Earth, Angry Birds, how is it possible that there's no innovation for women in undergarments? Right? It's like, have you ever asked, like, women cope just through that time of the month, every single month? And so the question was, can we create a pair of underwear that actually solves a problem? And so over the last 3 years, we spent sort of inventing a pair of underwear that's beautiful, breathable, washable, but also leak and stain resistant, moisture-wicking, antimicrobial, that actually solves a problem for women here during that time of the month and beyond. And the second part of it is that in my travels to India and Africa, my father's from India, I've been to India many times. And in my trip to Africa, I met a young girl named Amale on a weekday. And I asked her, why aren't you in school? And she said, it's my week of shame. I'm like, your week of shame? Like, what do you mean? And she basically told me that during her time of the month, she spends staying at home, or she uses things like sticks, leaves, mud, you know, plastic bags, old mattresses to try to stop her menstruation. It doesn't work. And so she stays at home, and I came to find out that she, along with 67 million girls in Africa and 100 million girls around the world, miss up to a week of school and drop out of school because they just don't have the right resources. And so just to help girls like Amale, we basically formed a partnership with an organization called AfroPads that produces washable cloth pads for girls. So for every pair of underwear that we sell here that solves a problem for all of us here, we fund the production of 7 washable, reusable cloth pads that goes back to a girl in a developing country. And so now we've already, you know, we've helped, we have a lot to talk about. And so now we've helped over 2,500 girls go back to school. And so this is also our mission, to sort of really empower women around the world. Okay, so speaking of empowering women and actually, you know, the concept of inspiration, you know, in the workplace today, you know, we are given so much information. We have access to so much. How can you within your organizations truly inspire a younger generation, Generation Y, Generation X, to come join an organization that has sort of a longer standing sort of existence?
So I forgot to say in my introduction, which I will only take another 15 minutes to talk about me, but I didn't say that I actually retired last year from Excel, and my intent was to retire. I was not going back to work. And what drew me back to work was the mission of AmeriHealth Caritas, which is really to serve the poor. And so for us, our ability to attract people has a lot to do around the mission. And so in particular with Gen X and Gen Y, that piece of it alone, knowing that we care about our members and we try to get the very best health care that we can get for them in the poorest of circumstances, really is a huge draw. So I feel really lucky to be able to attract people for that reason.
Yeah. Awesome.
So I'm a boring banker compared to all these wonderful stories. But I was going to go back to school out of finance for my MSW, because I felt in my practices in financial services that there was really a need for a deeper level of counseling. And so in my journey back to graduate school to get that degree, I realized that I did more good in the financial services area and being a good leader and a good manager than I would ever do being a counselor. So I think about that every day, because you don't really know when the words are coming in your mouth or when you're acting every day, who's watching and what they're going to learn from that. And so I spend a lot of time trying to think about that and also try to really understand everybody as an individual. And although I'm not their therapist, I sometimes act like I am, I think that that's really important to the fundamental of the growth of a company, a growth of a team, because people don't leave companies for the most part. They leave their managers, their leader. They leave something that someone's not connecting with them. So I feel it's really important to find that connection and find how they like to learn, how they like to be led, and beneficial, the fact that we're an education bank and helping people to do what's right. I think that's the fundamental conversation we have with our clients, and we should have the same conversations with our employees, and that really retains them at Beneficial.
You know, it's such an interesting question. I mean, I've had such a different experience with the foundation. I mean, we've been so fortunate, and it's been such an eye-opener for me, because we get applications for interns from, you know, Gen Y. I've gotten intern applications, I'd be serious, like hundreds from like in Harvard and Yale, and super smart girls who they just don't want to, you know, they don't want to just, you know, work to live, they really want to live with a purpose, and they know that their choices matter and that whatever they choose is really going to make an impact. And so they're so much smarter in what their decisions are, and I just feel like we're so lucky with this generation right now. And I don't know if you guys have seen the ads, you ladies might have seen it, it's an ad, the ads that just came out with the UN Women, and it's with, you guys should check it out. If you guys know in Google with the autofill, when you put in Philly Steakhouse and it says, and it finishes, it's autocomplete, right? So when you type in Google, women should, you'll find that it'll say women should stay at home, women should know their pays. Yeah, exactly. And then it says women shouldn't, and it's like women shouldn't vote, and then the women should be slaves. This means that this is what's actually being searched.
Yeah.
Wow. So I was like, this campaign like blew my mind. I couldn't believe that this is happening. I mean, this is huge that people think this, guys. Like, this isn't just something, this is the highest search engines in Google. So I sent this to a good friend of mine who's on my board and has been my inspiration and my leader. And you guys might know him. He's a writer. He's a Deepak Chopra. And I sent it to Deepak.
Oh, no, I've never heard of him.
And I sent it. I'm like, Deepak, what in the world? Like, this is insane. And he said to me the most beautiful thing, and it just made me feel so great. And it's in response to this. He goes, Renata, thank God that the future is in the hands of millennials and women. And it's not survival of the fittest, but survival of the wisest. So,
oh, that's great.
Yeah, so to your point, I mean, I don't really have an issue attracting them, because they just, I mean, I don't have enough space for them. That's really my problem. I wish I could harness all of these girls. And when I do get them, you know, I'm a huge believer, and I was reading this article by Anna Wintour, and she really, you know, she believes in her editors, and I believe in my interns, and letting them do things and believing in them. And when you believe in these young kids, they, without this structure that they come from school, they really blossom, and you'd be really impressed what I learned from them.
Yeah, well, so the concept, you know, the Dalai Lama said, you know, the world will be saved by the Western woman. And I believe that, because we have empathy, and that's one of the most important things in just the future of the world. You know, when you think about also the concept of doing good in the world, but also doing well financially, I think it's important to have that ability to actually be successful financially, which can also drive, you know, the top talent to want to continue to do good as well. You know, to have the ability to have both. How do you guys feel about that in the workplace? In the workplace setting, as far as, like, you know, attracting the best top talent, you know, through a financial purpose, but then also through good.
Well, I think automatically for what happened with the boomers. Boomers started out very idealistic and all about social responsibility. And as the years progressed and they had more and more children and financial obligations, they really realized that the financial part was as important as the giving back part. And so boomers then moved a little bit beyond that, more towards the materialistic. And it's all about the corner office and prestige and reserve parking spaces. Everybody that works with me now knows that I hate reserve parking spaces. but that change for the boomers was dramatic. And I think what the Gen X and the Gen Yers are doing for us is refocusing us on social responsibility. And so I do think you have to have the balance, right. And that's what you get a paycheck for. But we have a lot of employees that are welfare to work, and in some cases they have no idea how to manage money. And so many of them were homeless and now have apartments. And so we make baby steps with them and try to educate and help them understand the importance of finance. But it's amazing how little some people know about it. And you really have to work hard and you know, get people there.
Yeah, and I think also, you know, really the future, the Generation X and Gen Y will stay motivated at a job if they can, you know, see purpose behind it, and if they can be passionate about something for a really long time. And really, I think the future will only be passionate about something for a really long time if there's purpose behind their work. So how do you then sort of learn from each other? How do the boomers learn from sort of the Gen X, Gen Y? And is there cross-generational mentoring? Is there mentoring on both sides?
I think there definitely is, and it works really well. I think it's hard sometimes, a lot of times for the boomers, because we have to stand on their shoulders to get where we need to go, right? So that's difficult. And I think that a lot of it has to do with respect, acknowledging the fact that we respect you and that we're happy that you paved that way for us. But I think we mentor each other back and forth in a lot of different ways. You know, Gen X is a really entrepreneurial group, very independent. And so as much as we love to affect change, we've done it more by starting our own business or going off on our own to do those things, where Gen Y comes in and says, look, we need a team. I need you with me. Mm-hmm. Help me mentor each other to do this. We can affect change together. And the boomers, we kind of help them say, okay, it's okay to get out of your own head. It's okay to work with us. We're not in competition with one another. We're working together. And I think when you work together in a way that is not, you compete with yourself and your own accomplishments, not with each other, it becomes a much better way to be, and you can really learn from one another.
Yeah, I think the key for me has been really to get to know this generation, and really to get to know what this generation wants. Because I think, like in any business meeting, right, when you walk into a business meeting, the first thing you don't do is talk about yourself. The first thing you do is you ask that person about them, right? And you want to know those trigger points, and you want to know what really makes this person tick. So for me, it's always really getting to know them and getting to know them on a personal level. And I'll tell you what, like, what I have found out, the way that we compensate, like, if you want to talk about compensate with pay, when millennials, when they're posting things on Facebook, it's not like my generation is worse, like, look what I got. They're more about, like, look what I did. Right? So for us, you know, we are really good about, like, taking, like, you know, our employees out and showing them microfinance projects. Every single one of you here provide a service. And if you're providing a service that people are paying for, you're doing good. So your employees, your millennials, they just want to be able to experience that, because sometimes it's so detached. I mean, you guys, we do microfinance to empower women out of poverty. It's a little detached, right? Because we don't get to see poverty as much. Like, I'm from Colombia. I see poverty all the time and at home, right? But so what we do is, like, even we'll take, you know, some, like, our employees and our interns, and we'll take them to see microfinance projects that we do in the Bronx, because there's 18 million women in the United States that live in poverty, and there's poverty here at home. So for them to be able to experience what we do, it really compensates that. So I think for me, it really has been, A, getting to know them and knowing that experience is really important to them, and then showing it to them. And letting them take out their own lessons from it, as opposed to me telling them what they should take out of it. So it's been a big science experiment for me, in a way, learning this. And I've been doing it for a while now, but I guess that's really what I found has been most effective.
And I think the concept of, again, you know, purpose-driven work, if, you know, thinking about all of your businesses that you're in and all the companies that you're working for, you know, how can you really incorporate purpose in your company, which will then attract and engage the best people, you know, to come join the team and to stay. You know, it's one thing to have, mm-hmm. you know, young people come and join the team for the paycheck to get their student loan debt out of the way, but what's going to keep them staying is the purpose. So if you guys can, you know, continue to inspire, you know, your companies and your businesses through a mission, you know, that these young people can hang their hats on truly, I think that's when, you know, you guys will retain and attract the best people. How do you guys feel about that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah? So, you know, what as far as strategies to actually attract the best talent, what are some of the strategies that you guys have thought through and used to attract the best Gen X, Gen Y talent?
So I personally, I don't manage my workforce around the generations. Mm-hmm. And so what we try to do is be a really good employer with good benefits, with a great culture, because culture really matters. People want to know in the workplace that they matter. And if you don't clearly define your culture, it will define you. And so you have to be really clear about what your culture is and what behaviors you want from that. And I think culture can be everything, because really it's defined as what someone does when there's no one there to tell them what to do. And that's really what culture is. So having a strong culture really builds engagement. And so you move from this sort of attract and retain to engage and acknowledge.
Yeah, I would say, you know, there's a lot of different things that we can do as far as branding, marketing, things like that. But when it comes down to it, it's really about finding what's important to that person and connecting with that. So, you know, finding something within your organization and saying, okay, this doesn't make sense, let's fix it. Let's go up the chain and fix it. And to work for an employer that allows that is what really lets us have those one-on-one conversations and say what's important to them. Whether it be, you know, technology, the ability to Skype, flex time, you know, PTO hours. You know, it really is about connecting with the mission and then connecting with them and being able to affect change within your organization to have those people want to stay.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's always like, I always tell people when they start working for us, it's like, listen, you are a representation of this organization. And we have built a lot of credibility into this organization. And at the end of the day, I mean, I don't know if you guys know that, you know, all you have is your name, right? And so for us, it's, you know, as a foundation, that's really important. I mean, we're very much in the public eye. And everybody that works for us needs to be at their best always, and a representation of who we are and an extension of what we our values are. So for me, it's always, you know, I always, to attract great talent, I always am like, look, when the minute you start here to, you know, whatever day you're here, how long you're here, you're going to build a portfolio, and that's going to be a portfolio of who you are, and that needs to be a representation of what we've done together, and what are your goals, and how are we going to meet them together. So we become more like a team as to how are we going to get there, where do you want to go, because, and ultimately their goals are our goals. So it, you know, that's when you get people to work 150%, because you've now combined missions, and when you have similar missions, it's not work anymore. It's more of a passion play, and it's more of a value-based driven goal system. So I think in that respect, you know, I've had people, and the beautiful thing is the people I've been, I'm so humbled to say that they're like family to me now, because even if they don't work for me, I can still call them and be like, wow, I could really use your help on this project. And I can just count on them at any time. So that's really helped beyond an employee and build those stronger bonds.
Great, thanks. So, you know, we talked earlier when we were upstairs about just how, you know, in the baby boomer generation time, it was really when women started to appear more and more and more in the workplace, and men started to see women as peers. But women still have had a very hard time asking for what they want. Mm-hmm. The younger generation are much more comfortable asking for what they want, mm-hmm. right? And how does that affect the workplace? How do you guys respond to the younger set asking for what they want, which then inspires the older set to ask for what they want? And how do you answer that?
I say bring it on. Mm-hmm. I love it. I love it because I think, again, treating people like they matter, that you care about them, that you have a compassion, and that you want to listen to what they want, and then you react and you make change as a result of it. I mean, that makes you have a fully engaged workforce. And so when you think about people having this little reservoir of energy that they hold back and that's off to the side, and when push comes to shove and you need them to do something that's dramatic and they have to work really hard to get it completed by a certain time frame, they draw on that reservoir. And so what you want is to provide an environment that allows them to build it back up once you've allowed them to ask them to draw on it. So that reservoir of energy really can be kind of a governor of engagement, I think.
Mm-hmm. I think the Gen Xers learn a lot from Gen Y in this, because I think for a while we weren't asking for what we want, and it still may be very difficult for us, but they are sort of like, ask, come on. At the same time, I think that leading Gen Y can be difficult in that it's good for them to ask what they want, but then you have to set realistic expectations. Right. Mm-hmm. And they might be slower expectations than they want, but still faster than what maybe the boomers or the Xers had to do. But it helps you put a roadmap together for them because they ask for what they want. But then you sort of have to manage them to that roadmap because they want to know whatever time they're spending is part of that roadmap. Mm-hmm. They don't want to, you know, do something that's not where they want to go. So
how do you feel about the whole concept of like putting in your time? And so, you know, the idea that, you know, a lot of the younger generation, they come out of college expecting to get a job. Yeah. They come out of college expecting mm-hmm. to, like, get, you know, as soon as they start their internship or start their job, they're like, where's my raise? When's this? When's that? And you're like, listen, honey, put in your time. Yeah. You know, and so how do you manage that where you're like, okay, I get it. Like, you're asking for what you want, but do they deserve it at what point? You know, so how do you manage that?
And I think that, you know, Gen Yers came from a society, and it's all about how you grew up in your culture, and a lot of them, I mean, not everybody, came from a culture where everyone won, you know, and mm-hmm. they got reward just because...
Participation trophies suck. I hate participation trophies.
They got rewards for effort and not results. So I think to say, okay, you have to have results first. Mm-hmm. It may not be, and it doesn't have to be like the punch the clock, how many hours mentality, but what results did you drive? And what results can you put your, you know, you worked with your team and you can put your name on to move a company further. And so, yeah, it doesn't maybe not take as long, but it's going to take time. You're not going to come out of college and be the CEO. Right. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I think that's so interesting because, I mean, we come from a generation, like, I remember one of my employees come back, she's like, oh, yeah, I'm went to New Zealand and I'm a surfer now. I'm like, what do you mean you're a surfer now? She goes, yeah, I surfed. I'm like, how does that make you a surfer? I said, I couldn't call myself a surfer unless, like, I was a real surfer. Like, I was surfing for, like, I couldn't call myself a surfer unless I was surfing for, like, 5 years. You know, but, I mean, they just, there's this sense of entitlement. I'm like, wow, you can call yourself a surfer just by doing it once? That's awesome. So I kind of, and I kept on seeing that over and over, and I was like, and entitlement. And so for me, this whole goal-based thing is really important because you can't reach a goal unless you get it done, you know? So for us, it's like, oh, you really? You want to do that? Okay. So these are the objectives and these are the goals and these are the timelines. And when we get there, we're going to have a conversation. But the thing is, they're just so used to immediacy, you know? And it's like, man, I still remember like when I had to like wait by the phone for a phone call at my house and like we like worked for stuff, you know? Like, and here they have a phone all the time. It's like, you have no idea what we went through. Instant, everything is instant. And I'm like, and so I always make those steps a little harder than what they normally are. You know, I'm like, you're going to go do this, but actually you're going to walk there. And you're going to, so just so you understand what it would feel like, you know, so you have a sense of reality. And I don't think I'm that they love me for a period of time. But I think that ultimately, you know, they get it. You know, they get it. But there is this little, you know, I do put them through a little bit more hoops because, you know, we had it harder. We weren't just so easy to be called a surfer. Like, when that happened, I was like...
It's like when you start putting a comma where it's supposed to go and start spelling there in the right homonym way, then we'll talk.
Well, they have grammar check to do that.
You know the problem with instant gratification? It's not fast enough.
Yeah.
But I do think that you have to emphasize, what are you doing of significance and what have you learned? What did you learn from that conversation? What did you learn from that experience? Because it's really about lifelong learning. That's no matter what it is.
Yesterday I basically had an evaluation with my assistant, and we just kind of sat across and evaluated each other. And I said, "How do you feel?" And she said, "I feel really good." And I said, "Well, what are the things that you think you need to work on?" And she said, "Anticipation." And I was like, "Oh my God, she learned something." And so the idea that, you know, the best people will move up the ranks if they anticipate what your needs are. And then if they come up with an idea and present it to you, how do you inspire sort of your younger set to really come up with ideas knowing that they're at the bottom of the ranks, but still, you know, have an idea and be able to present it to you and then know that it possibly could, you know, be materialized?
Well, I think it's the environment of how you tease those ideas out. And so if you have brainstorming sessions or however you do it in your workplace, I think the idea is to allow people to feel free, to have degrees of freedom on a particular project or something, to be able to really empower themselves to come up with the idea, and then you can react to it. And I was actually just talking to somebody the other day about this one meeting that we have at our workplace, and it doesn't go so well because it feels a little bit like a firing squad. Mm-hmm. And what you want as women is to support each other and to say that idea has some merit. Let's talk about how it has merit and really tease out the thing from it that might be able to work. And we just have to do that. We have to do it with each other. We have to do it with our own teams. I think it does work, though.
So how do you inspire initiative and?
Well, I think it's really to advocate on a greater scale for them, for their ideas, and show that you're working on it, because change takes time, and change, you know, a lot of times it's not fast enough for them. But if you show them and tell them the process you're going through to get the change done and to really advocate for the idea and build upon it, I think that's what really keeps them connected. So to really, and have that open door to hear all of the ideas, but really show them the steps that you're working on to affect those ideas.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think there's certain people in the organization that I feel like, okay, I'm going to make an investment in this person. And I know this sounds really crazy, but the best investment to make for a person is to give them a task that they could fail at. Because if they fail, I'll tell you what, 100% of the times when you do the review, you say, what did you learn the most from? she'll say, that one time you had me do that event, and all I did was make sure I had the production right, and I didn't realize that I actually had to get people there. Mm-hmm. And it was the hardest thing for this girl to do. And then she failed miserably, but it was the biggest lesson for her. And she grew so much from that one lesson. Until this day, she's like, that was the biggest thing I learned. And she grew from that. And I didn't really need that event. I just wanted to see if she could pull it off. So I kind of set little things up to see if they can do it. And if they do it, then plus, perfect, that worked. But if it didn't, I didn't need it anyways. But she grew as a person in my organization. So I invested the time and the energy to hold her hand through a failure.
That's such a great next question, is the concept of failure. We're in a culture where failing is wrong, and that people have now established a fear of failing. Mm-hmm. And really, the only way to learn is to fail.
Yep.
And so how can you engage sort of, you know, the more we know, the sometimes the more hesitant we become to make mistakes. How do we continue to push the envelope and say it's okay to fail? And how do the younger set sort of react to that? Like, how do you guys allow them to fail forward? Except, you know, through that experience, for example. Right. Are there others in sort of a more corporate environment?
I think that the biggest thing that you said there was about fear. And it's debilitating to be in fear. So you're not going to gain anything by leaning in fear, by being in fear, by being afraid to fail. And I think a lot of people don't admit it to themselves, but they are. They're afraid of what people are going to think. They're afraid what their boss is going to think. They're afraid what the board is going to think. And you can't make any progress in that mindset. And so the idea that you can't you just can't have that mindset. And so I hear myself saying to my peers, my coworkers, you know, don't be afraid. What's the worst that can happen? You know, if it's really that bad, you probably can find another job. You're gonna land on your own two feet, but you're not gonna innovate or change anything if you run your life by fear. So, you know, I tried to find a really fun quote about that, and I decided that just saying it, just don't be afraid. Don't. Be in fear, because it's just a bad place to be. It's a bad place when you have a leader who is always afraid or is instilling fear in you. So don't be a leader that leads that way either.
I think allowing for vulnerability and authenticity as a leader. So when Sally spoke this morning about getting fired from Citibank, that was shocking to me. Now, I'm a boomer, so I'm coming from a little bit different place. You guys probably weren't as shocked, but I was shocked. I thought it was fantastic that she talked about that. I was really, really impressed with that. And I think as leaders, the more we can share that, being vulnerable is okay. Screwing up is okay. And the point is, you learn from it. And as long as you can keep that going and role model it for your people, I think it can really help.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of my biggest things. I mean, our foundation is built on paradigm shifts. So basically, the way you see things affects how you feel. And depending on how you feel is what you'll do, right? So we're all about shifting the paradigm. Really, like, really, I know it's so easy to say, oh, change the way you look at things, but seriously. And the only way you can change the way you look at things is by, you know, seeing other people and how they changed their paradigm. And so I'm writing a blog right now for Huffington Post, and it's called Paradigm Shifters. And it's all about women and what was their paradigm shift? What was that weakness that they turned into strength? And what was that biggest breakdown that really turned into the breakthrough? Because you really have breakthroughs when you have a breakdown. I mean, if you look at the guy, the vacuum maker Dyson, he had 465 prototypes before he figured it out. He failed 465 times, and nobody knows that. You just see a perfect Dyson. So I want to, my whole thing is to celebrate, not celebrate failures, but yeah, I mean, listen, you know, how many times do you guys meet people and it's like, hi, how are you? Everything's great. No, it's not. It's not great. and it's about, like, and to your point, just it's more of a society thing, and it's and talking about those things, because we all have really hard times, and everybody else thinks that you have a perfect Cinderella story, and you feel like, oh, it's just me, I don't have that, and it's not true. So I think the more we can highlight failures, the more comfortable society is with it, and that's one of the things that we're really focusing the foundation on right now as
like
well.
The concept of Facebook, you know, how like nobody posts anything bad on Facebook. It's like, great photos with my friends, and like, you know, birthday parties and baby photos, but it's like the vulnerability piece is missing. And so if you can share that more, to her point, and to your point, It will change the game. I remember one girlfriend of mine, she lost her job, and she literally posted this whole thing on Facebook. And at first it was like, eek. But then you're like, oh, my God, I love that. And there was like 500 likes. You know what I mean? And so it's like people are looking to sort of share, you know, to listen and just to hear, because you're like, oh, my God, I'm not the only one. I can't hide behind just the positivity all the time. It's okay. Mm-hmm. Right? So I think we want to, you know, turn it over to the audience and ask some questions. People have questions, please come on up.
When you were talking about fear and going forward for younger people, what about the fear that exists for the people that are like 50, 55, 60? Because they know they're going to be the first ones tossed out. So do they want to be innovative and do things that make them stand out where they could be wiped out?
Well, it's funny. When I spoke about fear, there are a lot of my colleagues that are feeling that fear. And I really feel like it doesn't let their personality shine. It doesn't let their ability shine when they're in that state. So, yeah, I think do it. I think if you hold back is when you might be let go because you're not innovating and you're not moving something forward and you're not creating change and adapting. So I think you need to be yourself. You need to be passionate. You're going to still be working probably a long time. So, unfortunately. And you should have fun doing it because that's where your true self comes out. So that's my view.
And also I would say that, you know, a lot of the older, so they're like, I'm not as computer savvy. Computers have been existing the same amount of time since you've been old as a young person's been young. And so it's the same amount of time. It's just now engaging yourself in learning how to use the machine and really understanding, like having the finger on the pulse on how to work it, and just have to put the time in.
And don't discredit yourself. You have so much experience to teach everybody else in the workplace of what you've done and things that you bring to the table. That's important. We need to know. We need you there.
Mm-hmm. I know I said this before, but don't stop learning. You've got to keep learning. That's got to be lifelong. I have mentors still, and I'm very old. So it's important. I mentor people, and I have mentors. It's a two-way street.
As a leadership coach, a psychotherapist, and the mother of two daughters, I want to say that the message to not be afraid isn't sufficient and empowering. We are afraid. Mm-hmm. All of us in this room have a lot of fear, and the issue is how to work with our fear so that it doesn't paralyze us and hold us back, but that we are able to work with it and go forward.
Mm-hmm. Great, great point. Mm-hmm.
I think I'm going to comment on that. I think it starts really with eliminating the negative relationships in your life. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it really starts there with those who sort of are the naysayers and the depleters and the people who kind of make you feel bad. Once you eliminate those people, the fear that's being instilled in you daily by a parent or by a friend, by this, by that, will start to dissipate as you start to find friends who support you and say, yes, go for your dream. Yes, go for that raise or go for that whatever. You know, having that, eliminating the negative and leaving, creating room for inspiring is important. And I think it starts there too.
I also think it's just getting out of your own head, like I said before, mm-hmm. because it's worse in your head than it is anywhere else. So really, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. just yeah. It's hard. I work on it every day, but that's how I do it.
And I would credit to that. You know, like it's really about being aware of your thoughts. I mean, you know, that's one thing that Deepak teaches me. He's like, do you ever listen to your thoughts? I mean, if you were to ever speak, just try it one day. Speak everything your mind says. It's gibberish. It doesn't make sense. It's non-consequential. They call it the crazy monkey. So when you become aware of your thoughts and you're like, wait, why am I thinking so negative? I'll tell you why you're thinking so negative. And I'll leave you on this note. It's really interesting. We're original cave people, right? Cave people always had to think, when you're a cave person, you're always thinking, what's the worst that can happen? A lion's going to attack me. This is going to happen. And you need that then. We don't need that negative mindset anymore, but it is part of us. Everyone here thinks negatively. We just do. It's part of us. So when you can become aware of your thoughts and you're like, hey, that's a negative thought, let me turn that one around. It's becoming conscious. It's awareness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's really good.
Hi, thank you all. I'm glad you brought up the technology a minute ago. We're, those of us in the baby boomer generation are technology immigrants, and you guys were born with a joystick in your hands. You just understand it innately. Can you speak to the fear in the older generation versus the assumption in the younger generation that technology is just a part of it? I'm still appalled when I'm given permission to tweet or Facebook or whatever in the middle of a meeting. I think that's rude. I'm old. I understand that. I understand it's not rude. But there are things to be learned from both sides. The younger generation needs to actually learn to speak to people face to face and shake a hand and look in the eye. And the older people need to learn that it's okay to converse. It's okay to share things as the event's going on or whatever. I just like your various thoughts.
All I can think of is my daughters and I have races. Me on my BlackBerry, they're on their iPods, and they always beat me. They always beat me, and it's because I have a dinosaur piece of technology that doesn't work. So part of that is I've got to change my own behavior. I realize that. I'm going to get an iPod. I have an iPad.
iPhone.
I'm getting one. Oh, an iPod. Sorry. That's right. iPhone. Sorry. That's what I meant, iPhone. Thank God Mickey's here.
Yeah. My 20-month-year-old son is better with technology than I am. So, and, you know, a lot of Gen Xers did not have the internet or computers when they were going to school either. So I love to learn from the Gen Yers because they do so much so quickly with technology. But technology is only a piece of it. My sister's Gen Y, and she wants to be something else every day. But, right, she's my nanny, but she wants to go to school for makeup. She wants to be a makeup artist. And so I said, oh, come to networking events. We're going to get you business cards. There's so many people who need makeup artists. And even the makeup artists here, I said, oh, she could be doing that. Well, then I'll have to talk to people. I'm like, well, yeah. You're going to have to talk to people if you want to be a makeup artist. So I think that, yeah, that's the lesson is that you can't hide in technology. It's a useful tool, just like there are other useful tools all through generations, but it can't be the end-all, be-all tool. So the personality and your people skills and networking are still the biggest tool.
Yeah, I mean, this is a hard one for me because I'm a Generation X, but I'm a journalist. I'm a writer at heart, so I love pen, and I love paper, and I love writing, and I like calling people on the phone, and even if they think it's rude and I should text them. So I have a really hard time with Twitter and a super hard time with Facebook. But you know what my girlfriend said to me? She's like, Renata, you know what? You need to get over yourself. Like, it's just a matter of you making the decision that this is really important, and you just need to learn it. It's really not that hard, and you're just making it more complicated than it really is in your head. So it's just like getting over it and like really trying it, you know, and sitting next to somebody that knows what a retweet is and a hashtag and all this stuff. So I think it's like this little fear of that it's so big and it's so crazy. I think it's just a matter of putting yourself out there, really. I'll just tell you on personal experience.
Yeah, and just saying, okay, I'm going to spend a concerted, like just like going to the gym, yeah. I'm going to spend 1 hour a day learning or doing social media or reading up about this. Just like anything you do in a routine,
yeah.
If you just start doing it 1 hour a day, it'll make such a difference. It's just about putting your shoes on and running out the door and actually getting on the treadmill, right? So.
Can I tell you a quick story? So my daughter lives in New York and worked for a company for 5 years, and she got a job offer. And she called me. She said, "I've got this job offer. I don't know if it's the right amount of money." So I talked her through it. I talked to her about compression, and you know, being with a company for a while causes that compression to happen. And anyway, she calls the woman that had made her the offer, has the discussion, goes through all of her points of why she thought she needed to make more money, And the woman said at the end of it, "My, you were so well prepared. I've never had a candidate this well prepared." And she said, "Oh, well, my mom's in HR." And she said, "I knew it." She said, "Does this mean that I'm going to be dealing with your mother on the rest of this offer?" She said, "No." But the truth is, she asked for a dollar amount and she got it. So it is about asking. Mickey, we were talking about this earlier. It's really sometimes all they can do is say no, right? What's the harm in that?
But also, as you know, as startup entrepreneurs, you know, where we hire, you know, people who you know, expect more at the very beginning. Again, as Renata said, it's really about hitting goals and having benchmarks and also setting, like, expectations, saying we're going to have our first evaluation in 6 months. Then it's going to be in 12 months, and then it's going to be 18 months. So now you know that you have 6 months to truly prove yourself as an important candidate that comes up with ideas, that takes initiative, that actually gets the goals and fulfills them properly. Then, of course, we're going to evaluate you appropriately. But I think it really, you know, it those things matter.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I mean, there was a study done on men and women, right? And so women had to evaluate themselves in the workforce. It was 50 women and 50 men. So, and it was 1 through 5. And then 40% of the men, their evaluations all were fives. And 45% of the women, average was 3. And we're really hard on ourselves, and that's true. But I'll tell you when you can ask for it. You can ask for things for yourself, which is the hardest thing to do. Look, if you ask me to sell a product for anyone else, I can sell it in a heartbeat. I can sell you ice to an Eskimo. When it's your own thing, it's so much harder. It's always hard to ask for yourself. So that's when you should ask for it most. But if you have skin in the game, if you feel like you own it and you earned it, you ask for it. And it's going to come through in your demeanor. But I think what we're talking about entitlement is like when we feel that people are just asking for things, and you're like, "But wait, you didn't even earn the surfer title yet. Like, you can't have that. You can't be a surfer right now. No, you have to earn that." So that's our point about entitlement. But as far as evaluating ourselves, and you know, if you work on yourself and you deserve that raise, yeah, you better ask for that because you own it, right? You deserve that. So I think that's the differentiator there, right?
The balance.
Yeah.
Yeah, so as Mickey said, get rid of the negativity, mm-hmm. first of all. That's the first step. And you just can't listen to that because there are jobs out there. You come see me after because mm-hmm. I'm growing and doubling my size in my company. So there are jobs. If you want to come to healthcare, you come see me.
Yeah. I think a lot of it also is there are jobs, but they might not want that particular job. And you sometimes have to take a job. You don't know what you're going to learn from it. You might have to take a job. Might be not the best job that you want at the moment to have a job. And then build on that. You know, I wanted to be an actress. I thought I was going to be. I'm a banker. Very different worlds. So I love my job. I love what I do every day. And, you know, I think you discover things about yourself even in jobs you might not have wanted.
Steve Jobs said that you know, in his speech at Stanford, he talked about the concept of connecting the dots. Anybody see that talk? Yeah, the idea that, you know, wherever your starting point, your starting point. You know, it's all about the journey. And as long as you have your you know, the idea of what you're passionate about and what you're doing right now is just going to be a contributing piece to that journey, mm-hmm. then don't worry about that. Just if what you're looking for is job security, you can get a job. Just ask her. She's got a job for you.
Yeah, and I also think it's like, look, we have to sell ourselves, right? And we are selling our net worth. And you're asking for a value. You're asking for a dollar exchange for that. So how am I going to get the best return on my investment? What is your investment? How are you different from everybody else? You know, I'm from Colombia, so when we grow up, we have to learn how to do 5 different jobs, right? Like we can do, if we're the manager, we're the salesperson, we made the thing, we sold it, we actually, and then we cleaned afterwards. So it's learning, you know, nowadays it's not one person knowing one skill. Like if you want to be marketable, you should learn a lot of different things. Like know how to market, know how to sell, know how to open, know how to close, know how to social. And then when somebody sees that on a resume, it's like, wow, this girl can do all of this. Guess what? Your net worth just went up. Your face value just went up. You're a great investment, and people want you on their team. So I would kind of look at it like that as well.
Hi. I direct programs for entrepreneurship at a local university. And one of the techniques that we use to kind of get to that fear of failure conversation with our young women and young men who would like to be entrepreneurs is the idea of a failure resume. And it's a technique that you may all have experienced in some way or another. But what I've learned through working with young student entrepreneurs is that when they have this way of sharing their failures with others who have failed, it's a really empowering thing. And so I've adapted it among my staff. And to get back to the idea of multi-generational workplace, I have several staff members over 40. I'm 54, and I'm always surprised that I'm old, but I'm sure I'm not the only one who feels that way. So we share our failures through this failure resume conversation, and it really, really helps. So I'm just putting it out there.
I think that's a great idea.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, last question. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Lauren. I'm 21. I'm a senior at Penn. And my question is, in every professional situation I've had, which admittedly is very small so far, I've always sought out the women. I want to know how they got to where they are, what their career trajectory was. I want their guidance. And I found 2 things. I found my closest friends and advocates and mentors, but I've also found that women have always been my most vocal opposition, and I want to know how to navigate that when I graduate this spring and enter the workforce.
Such a good point.
Yeah, like, I mean, there really are 2 kinds of friends. Again, there's those who inspire you, which equals support you, and those who deplete you, which are those who are like not happy for you when you're successful, not happy for you when you get the boyfriend that you love, not happy for you when you get a job that you love, not happy for when you go on vacation or tan, not happy, you know, like all the things that, and then there's the friends who are like, when I used to have friends who I couldn't call because I was like, ooh, I don't want to tell them good news because then I'd feel, it makes me feel bad, it makes them feel bad. I don't have those friends anymore. Now when something good happens to me or something bad happens to me, I call my friends and they're like, yay, and we go celebrate, you know? And it's like, those are the kinds of friends you have to have. And college is a really tough place where you start to have to really make a line with who those friendships are going to be. You are as good as the 5 closest friends you keep. You're the average of the 5 closest friends you keep.
Yeah.
I was just going to say one thing that I think our job is, especially the older generations that are ahead of the younger ones, is to lift each other up. And if I had one piece of advice to all of you in this room, it would be stop criticizing each other. Mm-hmm. Stop criticizing women. It demeans your own power, and it doesn't allow for the positivity that you need to have.
Challenge each other, though. Yeah. Challenge each other.
I was going to say, you know, the opposition is a really good way to, you kind of do a self-check, take the feedback that you find valuable, that the feedback that you're getting from several different people, you know, that you can take that feedback. But you don't have to take everybody's feedback, and you don't have to agree with what they're saying. And I agree. I mean, like I said before, you should be competing with yourself and not others. And the people that are maybe criticizing you are competing with you. They would do better off competing with themselves to be a better self than to compete with you. So just keep that in your mind. And it's hard. I struggle with this all the time. Mm. And, you know, it really is about, okay, do I want to take that feedback? Or maybe I don't want to take that feedback. And really be true to yourself.
Wow, I think that was like the most amazing question, because I think we can all relate to this. And listen, I'm in the sphere of empowering women. I've been doing this since 2005. My biggest supporters from the beginning have been men. I have been shunned mostly by women. And it was the hardest thing to learn. It was really hard, and it was so demoralizing. I'm like, I'm empowering women. Like, how can I only have, like, men on my board right now? Like, this is ridiculous. And this is the sad truth. And I think what's happening right now is there's a change in our culture, right? And I know your question was how to navigate it, and I'm going to get there in a second. But, you know, I think, you know, men are, look, men huddle together like, okay, this is a plan. How are we going to get there together? Women are like, okay, this is a plan. How am I going to step on you to get there? And that's just been the reality of it, unfortunately. That's just because women have been very catty. But I think there's a shift. There's definitely a shift. I see a lot more women supporters right now within my own sphere. And we're more kind of riding off each other's wings. But as far as how to navigate it, I'll tell you what. With those women who don't help you, you know, there's a, I think it was Madeline Albright that said there's a special place in women and help for women who don't help women. Which
and when
is,
I heard that, I said there's a lot of women going to hell.
Yeah. But the truth is that there's the women that you're talking about and that have shunned you, you probably need them, and that's why you're feeling a little bit like, I really needed her to say yes, because she has those keys. I would tell you what, you know, just keep that woman informed of your involvement. Just keep her informed. Like, hey, this is what I'm doing now. Hey, I just want to follow up with you. I just want to let you know this. And even if she doesn't answer your emails, she knows that you are just consistent and that you're not going to give in to her bullying or that you're not going to give in to her negativity. But you know what? And she'll ultimately respect you. And if you do that, like I did that for 2 years with one woman, and she's a really good friend of mine right now. And I would, persistence and being eloquent and to level. Don't ever treat a woman of level like if you're lower than her. Treat her to level. She's not dear Mrs. Black. It's like, hey, Mary, I wanted to let you know this, even though she's the CEO of a company, because you will talk to her to level, and you'll give her little updates to level, and she will one day treat you to level. So I will just give you that little final insight.
Thank you very much. Everybody, great job, buddy. 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 Great job.